Ladies and gentlemen, it's wonderful to see so many faces, and many of them are all struggle activists. They've just been woken up from their sleep. This is fantastic. It's also wonderful that this occasion is happening on this campus. And Max has just demonstrated through his illuminating address why universities are so important and why this university has a historic role which it must continue to play, whatever the odds. We are here today to celebrate. To celebrate Zora, Dawood, and her leadership of the Open Society Foundation. I don't know how much you know of the amazing job this woman is doing in running not just this foundation, she also runs a similar foundation in Indonesia. And yet she's present in both countries and she does nothing but excellent work. So let's give her a big hand. My talk is going to pick up on the theme that the greatest threat to the open society is inaction by citizens. And I want to remind you that on a Highfeld day 55 winters ago, determined optimists gathered to declare their vision of a new society. A free and open society. What the Congress of the People set down in the Freedom Charter, adopted in Cliptown on the 25th and 26th of June 1955, reverberates down the decades from the mid-20th century to this succeeding millennium. The first article of faith in the charter is that the people shall govern. A sentiment and injunction stated very clearly also in our constitution. Every citizen of South Africa, indeed every person who lives in this land, regardless of ethnicity or nationality, has a role to play in nurturing and protecting that principle. And we must do more. We must proclaim it throughout this beloved continent, because after the Soccer World Cup, more than ever, it falls to South Africa to lead the way in Africa. Undeniably, we are the engine that powers Africa's economies. That is an achievement, a rigorous test, commendably passed. But there is a more profound challenge, a fundamental examination of our humanness, our nationhood, and our ability to inspire. Can we also become the spirit that powers democracy on our continent? The Sterkfontein Caves in Gauteng have the remains of some of humankind's earliest forebears, showing that long have we been integral to the development of our species. Now we must extend that legacy of our ancestors. We must ensure that South African society is one in which all doors are open to all, South African and non-South African alike, and where human rights and equal rights are a staple of the everyday and not mere words on the pages of our Constitution. In such a society, an ideal towards which we strive, for it is not yet a reality, there is no room for xenophobia, a compliant judiciary, ailing Chapter 9 institutions or censorship and state oppression under the guise of protection of information. In short, the state and the people must be able to trust each other. Society must, by definition, be open, transparent, and accountable. That entails the rule of law, government accountability, and government responsiveness. None of this is new. The creation of exactly such an open society is the principal aim and founding tenet of our Constitution. But how does one measure how freely information flows or the level of state's adherence to the application of the rule of law? Is it possible to quantify and grade accountability and responsiveness of government? In sum, is it possible to say how far South Africa has walked down the long road to an open society? These questions are significant because those who drew up the South African Constitution knew full well that its success in practice would lie in creating an open society and keeping it in rude health. Still, you might ask why this emphasis on open society. After all, the Constitution hardly uses the term open society or its partial acronym, openness, beyond the preamble and founding provisions. Yet, they are there, ever present, in the pillars of the House of Freedom, where they are pledged as access to information, freedom of expression, accountability, and the rule of law. We are here this evening to celebrate a barometer on how open our society is. The Open Society Monitoring Index assesses the degree of openness in South Africa. Whether you love or hate acronyms, here is another one. OSMI. Remember it, because it attempts to do something valuable, assessing South Africa's progress in creating an open society. Let us pause and step firmly into the prevailing political circumstances. At first blush, the Protection of Information Bill has a comforting ring to it. But the bill, if enacted, could very well be used to make our society less open, less accountable. Citizens could be deprived of information and ultimately freedom of expression would be inhibited, if not choked altogether, for fear of the punitive measures the bill contains. Would we, the people, in whom I include the citizenry and other residents of South Africa, choose not to know of government tender irregularities, of unauthorized expenditure of taxpayers' money, of profligate behavior that suggests disregard for accountability and the rule of law? I think not. I hope not. I believe not. The behavior of public officials counts a great deal, and not only in the general compact with the public, the citizens of a nation. You might recall that the father of the ideal of the open society that Max has already quoted, Karl Popper, pointed out that although individual freedom is the critical element in an open society, the state is mandated to prevent human suffering. Ask yourself then about the efficacy of future public policies if they were not based, or if they were to be based on flawed information, designed in secrecy, and promulgated without the benefit of prior robust public debate. Ask yourself, too, how the rash of irregular and unethical behavior by senior government officials would be contained without the sort of public callings to account that the media has made in this and other years. Let us not forget that it is the people who shall govern. And the people can govern only if they have access to information, if they are free to express their opinions, and if they are free from all fear that government will victimize or criminalize them should they disagree with it. The people need to be confident that the government can and will be held accountable, that the rule of law cuts both ways and is not perverted to punish only those who disagree with the ruling party of the day. It will be well to remember here that in his foundation text, The Open Society and Its Enemies, Popper demonstrated that achieving substantive goals such as removing inequalities or entirely transforming societies depends in the first place on an open society being in existence. So don't listen to the story that you, for delivery, quote unquote, to take place, somebody needs to be in control. Sorry, it's the opposite. What then is this open society? And how can we best help to bring it about and to maintain it? Open society embraces the other, the stranger, the foreigner. Open society is not xenophobic. New blood, fresh ideas, and other ways of seeing the world, thinking about the world, and living in the world are the oxygen of open society. Open society stops to savor the new scent, to taste the difference. Open society struggles when it does not have the information it needs to understand the world. Open society suffers when government is not inclusive, accountable, and responsive. Open society is grievously injured when the rule of law is impeded or worse, effectively suspended. Forging and maintaining open society in South Africa is vital because it is the clearest way to distance ourselves from the past and to remain steadfast on the path where our larger social aims may be achieved. But the way forward is not easy. The situation calls to mind a celebrated line of poetry. And I quote, "The woods are dark and deep, and we have miles to go, and promises to keep before we sleep." The current political environment is unpromising, to put it mildly, if not downright forbidding. We are faced with the oddest of democratic scenarios: continuing hegemony of one party. Gratitude for liberation should not mean unending gratitude to the leading movement in that process. Here, of course, the imperishable figure of Nelson Mandela inserts and asserts itself. But respect for and devotion to that saintly figure does not require it as its corollary, unthinking and uncritical support for the dominant liberation movement with which he is associated. It is very human to be caught in the seductive embrace of one's liberators. But it is irresponsible and shirking of one's civic duty to continue to entrust the future of one's society solely to a party or parties associated with the liberation struggle. But who liberated South Africa? Liberals enjoy thinking that it was they who liberated us, rather than liberation movements. Those very liberation movements claim the honor. But of whom were or are they composed? Ordinary people who fought apartheid every day, first by surviving, then by resisting, and finally by rebelling. We seem to have forgotten that. It is the so-called ordinary citizen of this land who freed it. No guns blazing over the Limpopo River. We do not owe the ruling party thanks for our freedom. Rather, it is the party that should be grateful to the people of South Africa for this freedom. I cannot ascribe to reviewing or viewing history through the prism of red letter dates and important characters. The ranks of those the media love to call the great and the good. That approach to the stories of humankind visits upon ordinary people what the great social historian E.P. Thompson, a South African, dubbed unforgettably, and I quote, "the enormous condescension of posterity." Both Thompson and his intellectual heir, Eric Hobsbawm, strove to correct that skewed perspective. Hobsbawm named a collection of his essays "Uncommon People," noting that it, and I quote, "is almost entirely about the sort of people whose names are usually unknown to anyone except their family and neighbors. But collectively, such men and women are major historical actors. What they do and think makes a difference. It can and has changed culture and the shape of history," end quote. What complicates the situation here is that South Africa's authoritarian political, economic, and social history defines power as dominance and little about the practice of power since 1994 has changed that archaic and crude approach. That opposition politics are often portrayed as disloyal to the foundations of our democracy and thus lacking legitimacy exacerbates the problem. It is something of an irony that our constitution, in electing proportional representation as a means to promote plurality of opinion and choice, at the very same time weakens the voice of voters. Proportional representation empowers political parties and disempowers those who voted for them, because those citizens are deprived of the sort of direct representation offered by constituency mechanisms. Instead, parties determine members of parliament, and the citizens of the country are left underrepresented. I had the regret to say before, our electoral and parliamentary systems unintentionally promote group morality by giving too much power to political parties, with the resultant weakening of incentives for ethical choices. Ethical choices are individual choices that you and I have to live with our consciences upon. But we have handed over all of that to the all-knowable and knowledgeable people in the party. The road to impunity is littered with good intentions of group morality. Where that group consists of the ruling party, the public good is invariably undercut. The constitutional right of citizens play second fiddle to that much played ditty, the morality of the party and its survival. As a welcome aside, one should record that certain key figures in the African National Congress have voiced their disquiet about the tendency to rationalize the indefensible. It is necessary to speak of a group malaise in the body politic, for it is not only in the ANC that morality and survival bump up against each other. Opposition parties often are their own worst enemies, and those of the citizens and voters of this country who desire a meaningful broadening of the number of voices in the public sphere. 1 million people voted for the Congress of the People in the last election. But Bruder Tuss, the power struggle within the party, have left it unable to cope with its own ambition and promises. Factionalism within the Inkatha Freedom Party does little to advance the cause of democracy in the nation as a whole and in the IFP constituency in KwaZulu-Natal. The Democratic Alliance holds power in this city and province, but can the DA genuinely transform and become more than a party of choice for those who have semigrated to the Western Cape from other parts of the country? Of late, there are signs that the DA and the ID, the Independent Democrats, are edging ever closer to a marriage either of convenience, necessity, or true love. Such a marriage, if based on the desire to establish an alternative political culture that can promote serious opposition politics, could become a founding stone of politics beyond color coding. We should note that group morality is not only a political plague. It infects and infests the private sector too. For every one-party state, there are countless monopolies with their anti-competitive practices that exploit poor people. For each instance of politics of cronyism, corruption, nepotism, there are dozens of business deals lubricated by the same vices. Let us turn to the culture of impunity. Sadly, almost a defining feature of post-colonial African governance. It has its roots, understandably, in the colonial aftermath. Amid the euphoria of the post-colony, the hated overlords and overladies overthrown, it was natural that adulation and reverence were showered on the leaders of the liberation struggle. Soon, leader, party, government, and the state became compressed into an unchallengeable monolith. To the leader were accorded the rights and dues of a sovereign. To the party, omnipotence. To the people, the duty of unswerving loyalty. Down this road lay diminished government accountability and eroded sovereignty of the nation state. Today, such so-called state capture typifies many African countries, where the boundary between the party and government and state is indistinguishable. From this conflation of power grows the culture of impunity. You heard the quotation from Mtembu. He believes he owns you and I and this country and all of the people who live here. In effect, this is a creeping coup d'etat, often achieved with the approval or unwitting complicity of the people. This situation need not come to pass in South Africa. The people here were active agents of their destiny and will be so again, because African citizens cannot build an open society. And in the truly open society, the people are the ultimate guarantors of freedom. That does not deny the challenges of maintaining openness and liberation. To a significant degree, the populace continues to invest its emotional, social, economic, and political future in the hands that drew it out of slavery. But those hands have changed. No longer inured to hard work, they indulge instead in the profitable practice of reaching deep into pockets made accessible by the post-liberation empowerment landscape. But plainly, this is appropriation of state resources for party political reasons. Again, the cat's paw of state capture is a busy agent here, securing material benefits for a small, affluent elite and undermining the fundamental and innately high-minded intentions of black economic empowerment. As it stands, BEE today is an acronym for Black Elite Enrichment. There are no limits to the garish display of conspicuous consumption, opulent lifestyles, and extravagant spending that draw on the public purse. Such flaunting of power is not just vulgar. It is an affront to the spirit of the struggle and to the millions of poor people, still poor now, who fought for freedom and in whose name the struggle was waged. The legitimate aspirations and fond hopes of poor people are seen by the powerful and those in power merely as obstacles to further self-aggrandizement and the accumulation of absolute power. All the while, the people grow poorer and more disaffected. The gap between rich and poor becomes a yawning chasm, inexcusably overtaking even the scandalously huge Gini coefficient of our developing world partners and competitors such as China and Brazil. We have surpassed Brazil by a long margin. Does South Africa really wish to top the league tables that measure the disparity and grotesque inequalities between poor and rich in developing nations? Is that really what we want to be known for? I think not. I hope not. I believe not. Yet it is down this very road that we seem to be headed. Lying in wait are potholes and ruts filled with good intentions of a new nation and a post-colonial order of compassion and with the high and genuine ideals of black economic empowerment. Institutions tasked with oversight are increasingly subject to political appointments. The independence of the judiciary is potential cause for grave concern. So too, the state of Chapter 9 institutions, such as the Public Protector and the Human Rights Commission. And most pressingly, perhaps, looms the perils of the Protection of Information Bill. For the media, the early post-apartheid years were amongst the best years. But times are changing. And now the times are amongst the worst. In the immediate afterglow of 1994 and the subsequent adoption of the Constitution, freedom of speech and opinion, freedom of expression were more than protected. They were guaranteed. The iron-fisted censorship that applied during the apartheid regime fell away. Come 2008, those good times were under threat. The first try at passing the Protection of Information Bill was deflected by vigorous criticism from civil society, the media, and from within Parliament itself. Come 2010, the bill is reintroduced in a form that many regard as more severe and more insidious. As I have argued in public forums and in my book, Laying Ghosts to Rest, many of our leaders cast themselves in the very mold of the colonial masters they have replaced. Their revolutionary fire and love for freedom from oppression all too often have morphed into a passion for emulating oppressors and their methods. Perhaps it will warm the hearts of the left within the ruling party to know or to be reminded that Lenin was of the belief that for communism to work, a better human being would need to be invented. Sadly, perhaps, it is also true that for liberation and transformation to succeed, a better kind of post-colonial leader will have to be created. We need to heed Paulo Freire's caution in his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, that the oppressed can readily turn into oppressors unless a new leadership ethos is adopted. In late July, we had hearings before an ad hoc parliamentary committee on the Protection of Information Bill. At first glance, the intentions of the bill appeared well motivated, attempting to create a suitable democratic framework to manage sensitive information is indeed laudable. But as with so many well-intentioned ideas, those intentions are imperiled by the creeping provisions in the bill that might well halt the dissemination of information by the media or by elected officials upholding democracy who blow the whistle on inefficiency and corruption by public officials. On Wednesday, the 6th of August, as we remember, the Sunday Times journalist, Zilika Siwa Africa, was arrested at the newspaper's offices by 8 members of the Hawks. The police did not have a warrant of arrest, but took Wa Africa away on charges of fraud and defeating the ends of justice. The newspaper and its lawyers were not informed at first where Wa Africa was being held. This dramatic incident calls to mind the apartheid regime's contempt for the very essence of habeas corpus and its use of detention without trial. The Hawks seem to have behaved as if the Protection of Information Bill has already been enacted. None of this augurs well for an open society. Some of us still have the scars of being thrown into the back of vans without any warrant of arrest. And how can we forget so quickly, only 16 years ago? Closer analysis of the bill reveals it to be dangerously and perhaps deliberately vague in key areas. Take the excessively broad definition of national interest, which allows almost every level of government to classify information. Directly and ominously, the bill provides for the classification of state-held commercial information, such as tender proceedings and the workings of state-owned enterprises. These clauses would seem to provide a cloak for corrupt practices that would obscure visibility by the public. Those proposing the bill deny that it would be so used. Those opposing it say that its definitions are amorphous by design because of a possible intent to misuse and abuse certain provisions of this bill. Had the bill been enacted at the time when I was writing my laying goes to rest, I might not have been able to talk about Tender Park. Remember that beautiful suburb in my hometown, Polokwane, where up to today, everybody knows that the people who own those houses have stolen public money. Have you heard of any action taken against them? No. Very effectively, the Protection of Information Bill's draconian fines and prison sentences would bring guardianship of democracy to a stop. Why? Astonishingly, the bill makes no provision for disclosure of state information in the public interest. Consider by way of highly visible practical example of what this means. We have seen recent reports about the lavish expenditure of taxpayers' money by ministers, by bureaucrats, which would not have come to light if this bill was in operation. Is it not in the public's interest to know how much ministers and other public officials spend on luxury accommodation and entertaining themselves at taxpayers' expense? I would have thought that would be common sense. One has to ask why our political leaders persist in their hesitance in demonstrating their political will to foster accountability and transparency in politics and governance. You know, if corruption stopped, there would be no need to protect information because the information would be so good you want the whole world to know. Perhaps it is because to be answerable to and open with the public is to come too close to the idea of the people shall govern. It would appear that the South Africa favored by sponsors of the bill is one with restricted public access to information, limited government provision of information and strictures placed on independent news media. All these restrictions are to be done to protect the national interest. Who is the nation whose interests are referred to here? Citizens would be very worried to have those who should be accountable to them deciding on the parameters of such accountability. Don't you think it's a little unwholesome? Only the most phlegmatic of temperaments would be unconcerned when faced with these prospects. Furthermore, those institutions tasked with oversight are increasingly subject to political appointments. We, the people, need to strengthen and guard those statutory bodies that monitor accountability. As citizens, we must demand that Chapter 9 institutions act vigorously and with integrity to hold public officials accountable and our leaders accountable. Oversight of another type occurs in the judiciary, the independence of which is arguably under threat. A significant number of appointments in all branches of the judiciary have drawn censure from seemingly political motivations. New names, even on the Constitutional Court, perish the thought. The ultimate keeper of citizens' rights have drawn criticism. And what is to be made of the reluctance of government departments to comply with court judgments that affirm government's obligations to realize the socioeconomic rights of citizens. None of that augurs well for the open society that lies tantalizingly within our grasp. Let me recap. Open society is blinded when it does not have information it needs to understand the world. Open society suffocates when government is not inclusive, accountable, and responsive. Open society is voiceless when the rule of law is impeded, or worse, effectively suspended. Comes the moment, comes the means. We need to know how open our society is. And I think in this barometer that the Open Society Foundation has established, we have indeed an instrument that can be used by us as the public to make sure that we indeed hold our leaders accountable. I'm going to close by reminding us of what Max so ably said earlier. Citizens must commit anew to engaging with one another to find ways of reshaping the social, economic, and political spheres so that openness is a staple in our lives. Politicians must bind themselves to transparent, accountable, and responsible government. The quality of a genuine democracy can be measured by how open it is to a multiplicity of voices. An open society, and with it freedom that so many fought for so long, can be sustained if the people are prepared to defend, protect, and promote it. The quality of our democracy and its openness depends on the level of engagement of citizens. It is a sacred duty. And I'm sure my Archbishop will say amen. Of all citizens, to guard this democracy. The democracy of South Africa belongs neither to government nor to any political party or political class. Freedom, democracy, an open society in the making are the people's to have and to hold. The people shall govern. Thank you.